accession number 28676, Mr. Jack Ball, Rail 6. Now, what were you converted to, the 1667 heavy conversion unit? I mean, this
we were flying Halifax ones.
So are they four engine or?
Yeah, four engine with the Merlin engines. They weren't very successful, I don't think.
Why not?
Well, they seem to be the crash rate at Santoft was such that they called it Pranktoft, you know, and the most of the crashes were caused by fuel failure after takeoff or somewhere during the flight, because the fuel levers were quite complicated. They operated from quite small tanks distributed over the wings, in the wings, and they were out of sight under the rest bed, so, you know, and the pilot couldn't get at them, so he was reliant upon the engineer to, well, we'd been joined by an engineer by this time at this place.
We'll come back to him, because I guess there would be one. So this fuel, it was just a complex job, and you couldn't do it, so you had
I couldn't
to trust
do
else.
It, and I had to trust somebody else, and clearly there was a lot of planes crashing at the time, because, as I say, the death rate seemed to be quite high there.
You didn't obviously have
an
incident. What did you think of the Halifax, other than the fact it would crash? I mean, what was it like to fly?
I didn't like it, quite honestly.
Why not?
The throttle levers, the four throttle levers, were too big for my hand, you know, and I've got a big hand, so I couldn't span them, and so you had to have the engineer push the throttles up after you. There was the fuel system, which was ridiculous, I thought. And you had to have the engineer, if you were changing tanks, you had to have the engineer go back and repeat to you what he was doing, you know, just check what he was doing. And so you had to memorize the fuel system. We were instructed by one of the instructors, I remember, was Ted Evans, who got the Conspicuous Gallantry Medal over Berlin, which made him unusual. He'd been promoted since that time, obviously, and he was a flying officer or something. And I had him for instructing quite a number of times, and I remember one fine day we were landing, and I made a hash of it. I didn't cancel out all the drift, and there was a bit of a crosswind, so we weathercocked into the wind, I guess, and went herring across the grass, scattering football players either side, you know. And he said, well, I'll show you what you've done, and so you won't be able to have to do it again. And he got exactly the same result, unfortunately. So there were red faces all around, and I don't think the football players were amused. I don't think the crew were amused particularly, but that was the incident.
Weathercocks means, could you just explain to them what it means?
Turning into the wind, I guess, yeah. I quite frankly, I don't know what happened, you know, suddenly shot off at an angle. I didn't intend to do it, and, it was my first experience of it, but I guess that was it, and I never liked the Halifax.
Were they heavy machines? I mean, did it
they
feel
very,
heavier?
They felt very heavy, I think, and they weren't successful with the Merlin engines, was unusual. When they re-engined them with Bristol Hercules, I think, they were a very good aircraft. You know, they had a little more power, and it seemed to suit them. And they was, but that thereafter, they mainly they were Halifax 3s that you encountered, and I think most of the bomber fleet was they didn't fly Lancasters, they flew Halifax 3s.
Now, anything else while you're at the conversion unit?
He recommended, this is Ted Evans, he recommended going to Kelston, which was a small airfield, not small in area, but it wasn't one of the main ones, and it's quite unusual. He'd been stationed there, apparently, and he said it was a very good atmosphere there. Not too big, not too much bull, and a good CO and a good station commander, which was quite important, really. And so myself and two pals, who Jock and Taff, we applied for it, but only I got it. And they went to Ludford Magna, which was the next station down the road, west of us, and they both got killed there, because I think one of their problems was that they carried an eighth man, a German-speaking wireless operator, who was a German speaker, who was supposed to give the force instructions to the German fighters. So they were German-speaking, and I think they were generally, they tended to I don't know whether they went along on other raids purely for that purpose, but I guess there were several probably attached to other squadrons in that respect. I don't know.
Now, so you went to Kelston. Now, which squadron were you joining there?
This was 625 Squadron. And it was just as Ted Evans had told us.
Which group? Do you know?
It was one group, yeah. Oh, sorry, we've missed out Lancaster Finishing School.
Oh, right. Better do that first, yeah. Now, when did you do that?
It was number one Lancaster Finishing School at Hemswell in Yorkshire, which was a permanent station, and we were just there for
Hemswell.
Hemswell, H-E-M-S-W-E-L-L, and we were there for about 10 days, I think.
You were you'd been at Santoff from July till when?
Santoff from July till August.
44. So not long there.
No.
And then at Hemswell just in August.
Just for 10 days or so, yeah.
Now what were you doing there?
We were learning to fly the Lancaster, and clearly it wasn't too long before we were. It was a lovely aircraft to fly.
Now tell us a bit about what the Lancaster was like then.
It was stable, safe. It carried an enormous load, of course, with 16,000 pounds of bombs. It was well armed, or as well armed as they could make it with 303 machine guns. And I think later in the war, although I didn't experience it, they had 2.5-inch, 2.5 in the rear turret. It had self-sealing tanks, so that hopefully it wouldn't catch fire.
What was it like to fly then for you? I mean, in comparison, say, to the Halifax that you hadn't liked.
Well, it was the throttles were arranged. I know this seems a minor point, but the throttles were arranged so you could control them with one hand. The two outer ones were bent over. Quite a simple thing, but very effective. And the fuel tanks were controlled from the flight engineer's position alongside the pilot, so in an emergency the pilot could you just had four sliders really, so that you didn't have to attend to the fuel at all once you switch it on. And that was
it doesn't sound like it was such a heavy aircraft. I don't mean it may have been heavier in actual weight, but heavy to fly, you know what I mean? Did it seem
it was better balanced, I think, than the Halifax. It was safe and stable and capable of very heavy use, quite frankly, because in the corkscrew, which was the sort of defensive maneuver, you place considerable strain on the aircraft and on the crew as well, but it seemed to stand up, and as far as I was concerned, it was all the controls were at hand. There was only one thing: there were two controls behind the pilot. One of them was the carburetor air intake heater, and the other was a petrol jettison thing, which I'll come to later, I'm afraid.
Now, you've got a new member of crew. I'm not quite sure when he joined, but this is the flight engineer. This is
he must be.
Now, who was your flight engineer?
Jock McIntosh. I think his experience was as a lorry driver, although he'd been in the... he was about 40, at least.
A sergeant?
He was a sergeant, yeah, sure.
And what was he like?
He was a very good dancer. His tango was a delight to behold. He was a wizened sort of Scotsman. He looked as if he had had a hard life, which he probably had done. I never got to know him particularly well, although he was alongside me, of course. I don't think technically he was up to much. When he was rough and ready in many ways, I think. When I had an occasion when towards the end or middle of my tour, when I had to turn on the carburetor heat, and unfortunately I turned the petrol jettison on, which made a big difference. This was on the way home, fortunately, and immediately the smell of fuel going out through the elephant's trunks, which dropped down from the wing panels, it made it clear what I was doing, so I immediately switched it off. But the engineer wasn't flying; I was doing a second dicky trip that night. In other words, taking a new crew on a job, and it was a bit of a nervy night, quite frankly.
I think we'll come back to this because it's a little out of sync. So you've got your flight engineer, your sergeant. Now, what about, was it here you were taught the corkscrew, or should we deal with that later on? I mean, were you actually taught it as a main evasion method, or would you learn it? You must have learned it somewhere.
Oh, I was taught it. I mean, I'm not sure whether we did it there.
So fighter affiliation was where you did this at Hemsdorf. Now tell me what fighter affiliation was.
Fighter affiliation was where the a local fighter plane, either a Hurricane or a Spit, came along and rendezvoused with you, and he would carry out mock attacks on the aircraft, and you would take avoiding action. It was as much for the gunners, because they had to aim, they had to lay off so much depending on which stage of the corkscrew they were in. So we were being taught the corkscrew.
Now, what was the corkscrew? How did you do it? People don't know now. I mean,
you put the aircraft into a dive left, turning left, and then you turn right, and then you pulled up right, and halfway up you pulled left. So in other words, it was designed to bring you back on the same track ultimately, if you were flying an accurate one. But it was hard on the rest of the crew. The pilot he was strapped in your seat, so you were flying it. So there was no problem, but further back in the aircraft it would be quite difficult to withstand.
They'd be thrown about.
They would be thrown about, yeah, sure. And I'm getting ahead of myself here.
That's something that happened later. Was it easy to do?
It was easy to do, but tough on the rest of the crew and tough on the aircraft, I think. You know, you took it to as much as you think it would stand, and I guess every pilot had a different opinion on that one.
Anything else you did at Hemswell?
Well, we learned to fly the Lancaster, of course, and it was a very short time. It was, I think we got about 11 hours in. 11 hours in, and the fighter affiliation, as I remember, I had a gunner missing, and I don't know why. He'd probably gone AWL or something, and or he was married or something like that. And I, to fill the numbers, I put the navigator in the Edon flying kit and acted as rear gunner at the time. So that was unusual.
Now, so the next thing is you go to 625 Squadron, number one group at Kelston.
Yeah.
And this would still be August, would it, 44? Or have we drifted into September just?
We drifted into September. I was at Hemswell from all my flying was done over about 3 days at 2nd, 3rd and 4th of September. So we finished up on the night of the 4th doing two flights, and that was a limit of our experience on Lancasters.
Now, what happened when you arrived at Kelston? I mean, you're arriving as a crew, a new crew to join 625 Squadron.
Yeah.
How do they take you in? I mean, you know, you're going to be one of their crews.
I was allotted a flight. I was in A flight, I think. The squadron leader was a bit... he was an old boy. Well, no, he wasn't old particularly, but he'd got long service. He was a regular flight lieutenant. Or maybe he was a squadron leader. He had a dog, as I remember, which was a pretty miserable dog. And he was a hill farmer from Wales, I think, basically. And he was morose, I would say.
Is this a flight commander or a squadron commander?
A flight commander, flight commander. The squadron commander was Wing Commander Haig.
Haig?
Yeah, H-I-R-A-I-G.
Now, so you didn't get much of a reception from your
flight commander.
What about the squadron commander? Did he brief you? I mean, did they brief you, tell you what was going on, make you welcome? Or?
I don't honestly recall, but what we did have was a talk from, the pilots had a talk from Air Commodore Ray, W-R-E-A-Y, who was a... much decorated pilot from the First War, and he said, you know, don't bother about the flak, just keep going straight through it, don't weave around, that just upsets everybody. And I put a lot of credence to him, because he was a guy who had taken a crew of six of sergeants, you know, to Berlin and places like that. He was a real warrior, and his personality made a big impression on me. And
he was an air commodore, was he?
He was an air commodore. He was from the base. Our base was Binbrook, which was a permanent station, you know. His point was that, you know, you're just wasting your time if you weave around, so best to go straight through. And I put that into operation, quite frankly. I'm sure he got a point.
Now, what was the officer's mess like? In fact, let's talk about, before we go into bombing and the rest of it, talk about the officer's mess, because we haven't really mentioned it yet. What was the officer's mess like at Kelston?
Well, it was a Nissen hut. Or two Nissen huts, I think, joined in the middle. It was very pleasant. The Spartan. There was a good atmosphere in there. We had the odd bloke who smoked two cigarettes at a time, and notorious for it. It was a bit nervy, I guess, and but otherwise it was pleasant there.
So what about the living conditions in there? Good or reasonable?
Oh, we were in Nissen huts further away. We had to walk to the mess, and it was a dispersed camp. In other words, there were roads running through it, and it covered a big area. It had two blue searchlights for recognition at night, because that was quite important, because the airports there were cheek by jowl. You know, you if you got on the wrong ring, they had Drem lighting, it's a big ring around, completely around them. And there were rings all over the place, you know, so you could...
I'll come back to that, because when we talk about a typical raid.
Uh-huh.
Now, what did the officers mess offer you? What was it like? Is it a bar or entertainment?
It was a bar, and we had that. That's about all, quite frankly.
And was it a friendly environment? In
oh, there? Yes, I would say so.
And what about drinking habits? I know, I mean, did people, well, yourself and other people, what was the drinking like? Because there's a sort of caricature, then there's a reality.
Yeah, it was limited drinking, I would say. I drank just the odd glass of beer, I think. And as far as I knew, everybody didn't drink before they went on an operation, or if they were going on one the next day or that they knew about, they wouldn't drink normally.
So it was much quieter than the popular picture.
Oh, I think so, yeah, yeah.
And it wasn't just you, it was almost everybody as far as you could see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, what about the food there? What was that like? Did you get anything different as officers than the men, or was it pretty much the same?
Well, I presume it was roughly the same. We used to go for, I can't remember where we went for the operational meal. We used to have an operational meal.
Now, let's look at a typical operation. I mean, I think probably if we look at a typical operation. Mm-hmm. Now, before we go on that way, let's talk about this training, because you went on a training flight. Now, that in itself is interesting. What did you do on the training flight with the squadron?
Well, I think it was just across country, and it's memorable because I think we nearly boarded that night. We were diverted to Lindholm after about 4 hours, and when we got there you could see the lights on the ground fine, and unfortunately when I started to let down, I got into fog at 300 feet. This is what they called an inversion fog, I think, or radiant fog, inasmuch as it was due to the ground cooling and affecting the atmosphere above, the damp atmosphere. So I was in a very tricky position because I'd done all this beam approach stuff, but of course the Lancaster was stripped of all these things, even I think the armour plate behind the pilot had gone and been replaced by painted plywood. All the blind landing equipment had gone, so I was reliant purely on the navigator, and we didn't have a alternate airfield to go to, so we were stuck there in the fog, and the only way I could getting out of it was getting the duty pilot, who's on the runway at the end of the runway, he's usually a sergeant, he's on the right end of the runway in a little caravan, and I asked him to via the control tower to fire off ferry lights when he heard our engines approaching, and then I got the navigator to give me a turning point to turn onto the runway heading, and I let down on the runway heading quite blind, quite frankly, and this was quite terrifying. And we made three attempts, I think. And on the, we went over the airfield at low level. Of course, we let down almost to the ground. And it was very hairy, indeed. And on the third attempt, I just glimpsed the, I had the engineer and the bomb aimer looking out of the nose, to see where the hell we were. what we were approaching. And on the third attempt, we saw the caravan as we flew over it. And quite honestly, I stuck it down as soon as I could on the runway. And breathed such a sigh of relief that I think we ran off the end of the runway into the mud. So it had to be towed out, which was humiliating, but it was just glad to be on the ground, quite frankly.
Did the rest of the crew realise how bad the situation was?
I think so, yeah, because they were... They knew that we were on the third attempt, and they were straining their eyes just to see through the fog, quite frankly. It was that thick that, you know, when we actually landed, you couldn't see anything even more. We had to be guided back to the control tower. And the apron, so it's difficult to think that it was that thick when you could see the lights quite from, you know, 1,000 feet, you could see the lights, every light going, but this was very bad. So that was my introduction to the squadron.